So thanks for coming. This topic is the Church in International Diplomacy. My name is Father Roger Landry. I work for the Holy See's Permanent Observer Mission to the United Nations in New York. Most of what I'm going to tell you, I have learned since I went there. I was a parish priest for 15 years before. There are priests who work in the Holy See's Diplomatic Corps who went to the Academia Ecclesiastica, it's called, the School for Diplomats, right there in Rome. I did not, but you pick up a lot quite fast. And Sam Gregg asked for this topic during this year's Acton Institute because people have been, in essence, looking for how some of these ideas have consequences, or the absence of the ideas that happen here likewise have negative consequences in the world. What I'm going to describe to you today is my personal opinion. I'm not here speaking with the explicit mandate of the Holy Father or my boss, Archbishop Bernardino Lauz, who is the Papal Nuncio, but he is very much interested in the work of Acton Institute. The opinions expressed are mine. I'm going to be focused mainly on the work of the Holy See, which is the work of the Pope and the Roman Curia together with him, on behalf of the Catholic Church with a capital C in Catholic. The work of the Catholic Church with a small c is obviously broader. But with regard to international diplomacy, the Catholic Church is unique among Christian churches. Diplomacy in general refers to the art and practice of negotiation between representatives of states. And in history, the Pope has had and continues to enjoy international juridic personality as a head of state, and like other heads of state, has sent and received ambassadors, what we call active and passive diplomacy. The Holy See has formal relations with 183 different states and before many different international bodies. It's the oldest continuous diplomatic corps in existence. Many other Christian churches have an influence in diplomatic settings. Many, for example, have representation with NGO status at multilateral organizations like the United Nations and before national governments. But insofar as they are not states, they do not participate in the work in the same way and with the same rights and responsibilities as the Holy See enjoys. So while I'll be speaking mainly about the Holy See and international diplomacy, I hope and know from the ground that many of the principles that inspire our work similarly inspire many other Christian churches in their interaction in the diplomatic arena. A brief outline of the talk, I'm going to give a biblical ground for the church's involvement in international diplomacy. Second, because I presume most here haven't been trained in diplomacy and might not know all that much. I did meet a French diplomat here. I'm going to give a brief history of diplomacy in general and the Church's diplomacy in particular, and then I'll finish with some perennial and present priorities for the Holy See's diplomacy at the international level. Let's begin, though, with the biblical ground for the Church's involvement in international affairs. Jesus summons his disciples to be the salt of the earth, the light of the world, and the leaven that makes the whole dough rise. These are powerful images. Notice what Jesus didn't say. He didn't call us to be the salt of the church. He didn't call us to be the light of believers, but the salt of the earth and light of the world. All three images, salt, light, and leaven, call for engagement, not withdrawal. The faith, life, and work of the church are meant to help, not the church itself rise, but the dough of society rise. These three images point to various realities. Just, if you don't mind, a little bit on sacred scripture. When Jesus used the image salt of the earth, there are three functions for salt. First and foremost function at his time was to prevent food from going to corruption. So you'd salt fish, you'd salt meat. To be the salt of the earth, we have to prevent society from going into corruption. That's very important in diplomatic work. Second function of salt in the ancient world was, sorry to gross you out, immediately after lunch. It was as a fire starter, because when salt was mixed with dung, it would become the charcoals to light the fires, the slow-burning, persevering fires in the ancient world. In some villages still today, I mean, one of the surprises that I had my first couple of months at the UN was a conference on energy to find out that 8% of the world still uses dung as fuel. But dung itself can't ignite without salt. And so what does that mean when Jesus calls us salt of the earth? That we're supposed to be a fire starter. We're supposed to be a catalyst. Third function of salt in the ancient world was what we still have today, flavor. Just a little bit of a Christian is supposed to bring some joy into a situation. That we're supposed to bring some flavor, some deep humanity to these situations, something a little bit richer. Without us, in other words, Jesus is saying, life is bland. So three functions just of salt: preservative, fire starter, flavor. Light of the world, the next image. First purpose of light is to illumine, to help people to see something better. And so the church in the middle of society is supposed to help it to see things more clearly, to see things as they really are. I don't know if you're my generation or even of my country and you watch the movies that I used to watch, but Die Hard 2, if anybody remembers John McClane and at Dulles Airport in the middle of the storm, putting down the torches on the whitened runway in the middle of the storm so that planes that were burning fuel and running out could actually land. The light that we're supposed to bring to the world is to prevent crash landings. Second purpose of light is to warm. We're supposed to bring a real warmth to society. We're supposed to bring a tenderness. Pope Francis is consistently talking about a revolution of tenderness. That doesn't mean a revolution of softness. It means a revolution of real caring. And so the church, as she interacts with society, is supposed to bring this care. And the last image is of the leaven, the yeast. Just a little pinch of us should be enough to lift up others. One Christian family on a street is supposed to make a difference. One person on a floor in a workplace is supposed to behave by different principles. So that what happens? Other people start to ask, why is that person different? Why does this person handle that contradiction differently than I do? To start to lift people up so that the whole of society rises. Salt, light, and leaven. There's a counter idea out there right now. I appreciate the motivation behind it. I just don't think it's Christian. It's called the Benedict option. Some of you may have read Rod Dreher's book. Rod Dreher is a great writer. But by these images, Jesus doesn't say go behind a wall. Jesus wants us out there. And international diplomacy is one arena in which the church takes the gospel out and tries to help others live at least by its values, if not by its explicit substance. Next passage, render to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, to God what belongs to God. There is a legitimate separation between these two realms. But there ought to be a cooperation for service, because each of these realms is supposed to be serving the true good of people. For many years of my life, I was a tour guide to the holy spots in Rome. I lived there for 6 years, did 125 Pope Vatican radio series, still lead lots of groups back to Rome. And one of the things that I like to point out is the church's conception of the interaction between church and state. If you go in, for example, to the vestibule of St. Peter's, the atrium of St. Peter's, if you look over to your right, you've got a statue of Bernini, of the Emperor Constantine, who legalized Christianity in the beginning of the 300s. On the left side, you'll see a statue of Charlemagne, Charles the Great, the first Holy Roman Emperor, who was crowned in the old St. Peter's Basilica, Christmas Day 800. Why are they there, I ask? If you go over to another patriarchal basilica, the Archbasilica of St. John the Lateran, right there you have King Henry of France in the vestibule. One of the vestibules, the older vestibule from 1586, newer vestibule from the 1720s, you've got Constantine there. If you go over to St. Mary Major, a third basilica, right there in the vestibule, you've got Filippo IV de España, Philip IV of Spain. Again, why in the vestibule? So what the church is depicting symbolically is that it's neither a late 20th century, early 21st century ACLU notion of a separation of church and state, which is a strict separation. If that were the case, the civil leaders would be somewhere out in the square or out in the street. On the other hand, the statues of the civil leaders are not inside the church, because that would more or less depict theocracy. They're out in the vestibule. They're not quite outside, they're not quite inside, to show the interaction and the cooperation between the two orders. Now, I have to say, the church herself, the Catholic Church, didn't always follow that principle, certainly in the Papal States, right, in which the Pope was both fully civil leader and religious leader. But that was always the conception, even if it weren't always practiced. Both orders are supposed to interact in rendering to God the things that are God's, because we are made in His image, and so we should be giving ourselves back to the Lord. Rendering to Caesar what is Caesar's, we point out these two orders. In 494, Pope Gelasius I wrote a letter to the Byzantine Emperor Anastasius, which he focused precisely on the interaction between these two orders. "There are two things, Your Majesty," the Pope wrote, "by which this world is principally governed, the sacred authority of the pontiffs and the power of kings." The letter of Pope Gelasius went on to underline that just as the emperor is subject to the bishop in spiritual matters, so the bishop and the pope is subject to the laws of the emperor in secular matters. That there are two legitimate orders that are supposed to be working together for the good of the human person. But there's one larger basis for the interaction of the church in international affairs. And that takes us back all the way to the book of Genesis. There's a beautiful summary of this in the 9th chapter of the Compendium on the Social Doctrine of the Catholic Church, published by the then Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace in 2004. When you go back to the biblical account of creation, the Compendium tells us, we see the unity of the Holy Family. The unity of the human family. We see how God is the Lord of history. We see how His action embraces the whole world and the entire human family for whom His work of creation is destined. God's decision to make us in His image and likeness gives us a unique dignity that extends to all generations. The book of Genesis presents with admiration a great diversity of peoples, the result of God's creative activity. But at the same time, it denounces man's refusal to accept his condition as a creature. For example, in the building of the Tower of Babel, humanity eventually became divided, but that wasn't God's original plan. When God made his first covenant with Abraham, he was named father of a multitude of nations, opening the way for the human family to make a return to its creator. Yes, there are a multitude of nations, independent, we could even say in modern terms, sovereign, but tracing back a common root. The history of salvation led the people of Israel to believe that God's action was restricted to their land. Little by little, however, the conviction began to grow that God was at work also among other nations. The prophets would announce that eventually what was happening in Israel would be a light for all the nations. Christian message offers a universal vision of the life of men and peoples on earth that make us realize that God's plan for the family is to be united. Its unity is not meant to be built on the force of arms or terror or abuse of power. Rather, it's the result of that supreme model of unity, which is, finish the sentence in your own mind. Thank you. Right on. I don't know if you could hear the whisper. The Trinity, the intimate life of God, one in three persons, what we Christians mean by the word communion. It's a triumph of the moral and cultural force of freedom in which we choose to come together. This Christian message has been decisive for making humanity understand that peoples tend to unite not only because of various forms of organization, politics, economic plans, or in the name of some type of abstract ideological internationalism, New World Order type of phrase, but because they freely seek to cooperate, aware that they're living members of the whole human family. The world community must be presented over and over again with ever-increasing clarity as the concrete figure of the unity willed by the Creator. This is why we can talk, for example, in Catholic social teaching about the universal common good, which is the common good of the entire family. The centrality of the human person and the natural inclination of persons to establish relationships among themselves, the outgrowth of the social nature of the human person, are the fundamental elements for building a true international community, the ordering of which must aim at guaranteeing the effective universal common good. One of the problems with the United Nations is that national interest trumps common good, international common good. Certain countries with veto power will always veto anything that's in their national interest to do so, whereas they sometimes sacrifice what's clearly the common good of so many other nations. It's something that constantly has to be overcome. The coexistence among nations is based on the same values that should guide relations among human beings. What are those values? Truth, justice, giving to whoever what the person deserves, active solidarity, not just passive, but taking action based on the feeling of solidarity, and freedom. Truth, justice, active solidarity, and freedom. The Church's teaching with regard to the constitutive principles of the international community requires that relations among peoples and political communities be justly regulated according to reason, equity, law, and negotiation, without recourse to violence or war, to discrimination, intimidation, or deceit. And none of this says that there shouldn't be national sovereignty, understood above all as the expression of the freedom that must govern relations between states. Sovereignty is the national equivalent of personal subjectivity. There is a national subjectivity in the political, economic, social, and even cultural senses. And these cultural dimensions take on particular importance as a source of strength in resisting acts of aggression or forms of domination that have repercussions on a country's freedom, as we saw, for example, in Poland under John Paul II. Culture constitutes the guarantee for the preservation of the identity of a people and expresses and promotes its spiritual sovereignty, because cult is what we really worship. At the same time, national sovereignty is not absolute. Nations can freely renounce the exercise of some of their rights in view of a common goal, in the awareness that they form, for example, a family of nations, where mutual trust, support, and respect must prevail. And sometimes they can lose their sovereignty when they're not doing their job. You know, one of the things at the United Nations that we talk about a lot, which is kind of shocking to the modern world, it should be shocking, is what we call the responsibility to protect. Across the centuries, we've talked about a just war theory. What's just war? It's basically criteria to prevent people declaring war or using means of war that are unjust. Because the natural inclination over the course of the centuries was to retaliate. Since 2005 at the United Nations, We have been talking about the responsibility to protect. The nations have a duty to protect their own people. And if they're not doing it or capable of doing it, the international community has a duty to intervene to prevent atrocity crimes, genocide, ethnic cleansing, etc. We have to talk about this at an international level because so many are kind of like that rich man in Luke 16 when Jesus talks about the poor man starving at his gate. When people are really suffering, many people just have the next meal, flip the next channel. They don't do anything. Not my backyard, not my business. No. National sovereignty can be given up. The international community can come on in. There are international humanitarian interventions that are absolutely just in order to protect people when their national governments do not. So national sovereignty is affirmed, but it's not an absolute. Let's do a brief history of diplomacy in general. When we talk about the word diplomacy and church, they might seem not to go together, depending upon what our definition of diplomacy is. To many, spirituality and diplomacy even sound contradictory. Diplomacy for them is practically synonymous with two things. First, with guile, the willingness to lie placidly for the sake of one's country's interest. Or second, with worldliness, with elegant receptions full of caviar and champagne. And they do happen. This is not the diplomacy that the church talks about in terms of international diplomacy. It understands diplomacy as a type of charism. And charisms, we know, are beneficial not to the one who receives them, but to the community. Their grace is given for the sake of others. In this sense, diplomacy is an essential art of a leader whose objective is the good of all and whose means to achieve that end is unselfish service. What is diplomacy? It's the art and practice of conducting negotiations between representatives of states. At a technical level, that's what it is. It can be formal or informal. Informal are kind of backdoor negotiations involving people who don't have full permission to do it, but who can advance the conversation. It can be bilateral, so one-on-one, or multilateral in big groups at the same time. It can be preventive. The United Nations basically exists as preventive diplomacy against World War III. It can be public, which again uses the media to get a message out to try to influence the soil. It can also be economic, using foreign aid or other types of economic policy as a means to achieve a diplomatic agenda. And that word diplomatic normally describes a tone and a mannerism with which diplomatic work is done. Traits that, of course, can be emulated by anyone. It refers to having or showing an ability to deal with people in a sensitive and effective way. Synonyms for diplomatic are tactful, sensitive, subtle, delicate, polite, discreet, thoughtful, careful, judicious, non-confrontational, prudent, politic, clever, skillful. These are in general different traits that are often employed, for example, in political settings. But diplomacy and politics are separated by a big chasm. In politics, at least my experience here in the States, a lot of the times it functions by conflict, whereas diplomacy functions by consensus. Politics can be win-lose rather than win-win. A lot of the times when people come to the UN, for example, to try to influence the work there, and they come from a place like Washington or some other capitals, they come with bullying techniques. You know, because a lobbyist can generally say, Senator, if you don't vote in this direction, I'll have no choice but to draw up 10,000 letters in your district, letting them know exactly how you voted. When that type of stuff happens at the UN, you become persona non grata. Because that's just not the tone. There's less of an acerbic, less an in-your-face mannerism, which is important to grasp in order to understand the history and the art. With regard to the history of diplomacy, the earliest sort of record that we have on it goes back 1,300 years before Christ to the Amarna letters between Egyptian pharaohs and the Amurru rulers in Canaan. There was a peace treaty in 1274 between Pharaoh and the Hittites. We have the Art of War by Sun Tzu from the 6th century BC, which not only lays out military strategies, but also practical tips for effective international relations. We've got the existence of the Greek proxenoi, which is just an expression that means pro instead of xenos, stranger or foreigner. It's instead of foreigners. So what the proxenoi were is, let's just say Chicago wanted to have diplomatic relations with New York. Chicago would find a New Yorker, generally a wealthy family, and that New Yorker would represent Chicago in New York. The New Yorker's chief loyalties were to New York, not Chicago, and if there were a real conflict that might lead to a real battle, the New Yorker, the proxenos in New York, would try to achieve peace, but if it really came down to war, he would be on New York's side. Generally, it was hereditary, but it was carrying out diplomacy at multiple levels. Economic diplomacy, military diplomacy, cultural diplomacy, etc. These were throughout the centuries BC. In the early medieval period, foreign emissaries began to get exchanged. A source from the 500s AD said, "Envoys who are sent us should be received honorably and generously, for everyone holds envoys in high esteem. Their attendants, however, their courtiers, the others accompanying them, should be kept under surveillance to keep them from obtaining any information by asking questions of our people." They recognize that around the ambassadors, like there are still today, there are spies. And they wanted everybody to know about the spies. Modern diplomacy basically began in the 1200s in northern Italy, where Milan established permanent embassies to other cities for economic and political purposes. 100 years later, Tuscany, the area around Assisi, for example, and Venice were flourishing centers of diplomacy. Many of the traditions of diplomacy still today come from that period in the Italian peninsula. In the 15th century, Milan began to exchange representatives with other countries, France and Spain and other European states, and those states reciprocated. Similarly, there was the need for many of the Italian maritime republics, like Genoa and Venice, to establish diplomatic relations with the Ottoman Empire. That's where the study of diplomacy started to take on new meaning, because people had to learn a totally different culture in order to be able to go into Byzantium or Constantinople and persuade according to the categories of the Turks, according to the Muslims, rather than according to their own. And so there used to be schools of diplomacy to help people get ready for that engagement. In the 16th century, there was the formation of the nation state, and that changed everything. Likewise, changed it for the Holy See. Prior to the 16th century, the Holy See basically had legates in all of these countries. We called them bishops. But once some of these countries ceased to be Catholic, there were still lots of interactions that needed to take place at other levels. And so what happened is that the popes began to send nunci, ambassadors, to these non-Catholic confessional states, and those were reciprocated. Diplomacy would be greatly disrupted by the French Revolution and the warfare that flowed from it. Napoleon stopped basically following every diplomatic convention there was. So diplomatic immunity was out. Diplomatic correspondence, which was always privileged, out. He was confiscating it for military advantage. And so after Napoleon himself was defeated, there was this Congress of Vienna in 1815, which looked at the bigger new world that had come about and came up with a whole bunch of rules and conventions to govern it. And most of those are still very much applicable today, more than 200 years later, although in some areas they have likewise been updated. Let's talk about the diplomacy of the Holy See. It can be a little confusing, that expression, Holy See. Where does it come from? It comes from a Latin expression, sancta sedes, literally holy chair. Because a chair is a symbol of authority, especially teaching authority. The Catholic Church celebrates, for example, every February 22nd, the feast of the chair of St. Peter. It's not a celebration of a piece of furniture. It's a symbol of the teaching authority. In the ancient world, when teachers taught, they sat and all the students stood and took notes. It's the exact opposite of what's happening right now, right, in classes everywhere, including here, which is the inversion of the whole thing of teaching. One of the reasons why I think students are always right in their dispute with their teachers. But the chair is like a judge's bench or a gavel today, a symbol of that authority. So when the expression sancta sedes was used, it was used to refer to both the spiritual authority of the successor of St. Peter, the Pope, as well as the civil authority of the Pope. Over the course of time, more and more civil authority was ceded to the church, because after the barbarian invasions, there were no real legitimate authorities left, even though there were vestiges of things like the Roman Senate. And so there were some celebrated occasions of how the popes themselves needed to intervene in history. When Attila the Hun was coming down and ravaging northern and central Italy, the inhabitants of Rome went to the only one who they thought had any heft whatsoever to do anything to prevent Rome being destroyed, who was Pope Leo the Great, Leo the First, Pope from 440 to 461, and asked Leo to go up and intervene with Attila. What happened? They went into a tent. They came out of the tent, and Attila said, "Boys, we're going north." What happened in that tent? History didn't record it exactly. The rumor spread that while they were in the tent together, Leo pointed over his shoulders, and you saw Peter and Paul coming down. Peter with the knife that chopped off Malchus's ear. Paul with the sword of the Holy Spirit, basically saying, if you're going to go through Leo, you're going to go through us. And then Attila, the warrior, got chicken, and he started to run away with his troops. That was what the Romans thought. And so Leo the Great's reputation, he was the best Latinist the church has ever had. He's considered better than Cicero in his own lifetime, written all this poetry. Everybody loved him. He brought the Council of Chalcedon and the earlier ecumenical councils to a conclusion by the power of his writing when he had sent over his own tome. But if his reputation weren't high enough already, it had just gotten higher because he had now had this massive victory in the civil sphere. What likely happened was that Rome authorized a payment of a tribute in which Attila would be able to get money to leave Rome alone. So that's what we think happened, even though we don't have record of it. Another famous case is with Gregory the Great, when he was sending the monks from the first Benedictine monastery that he had founded in Rome to the various sort of Frankish kings, etc., because they were illiterate and they couldn't read. And so the monks were able, in a sense, not only to help them govern, but to evangelize them. So the church began to grow in its civil jurisdiction, and this is likewise contained in the term sancta sedes. Refers to both religious and civil authority of the Pope and those who work with the Pope. Holy See's diplomacy is atypical. It's sui generis. What's different? Bilateral relations between the Holy See and any given state differ from those between two states. First, because unlike two states, let's just say the United States and Canada, it's rare that you're going to have citizens of both. Whereas when the Holy See engages in diplomacy with a state, there are almost always Catholics there. So the Catholic Church is never really totally foreign anywhere. This is one of the reasons why, for example, the Vatican doesn't have a foreign ministry or a foreign minister. The one who carries out that function is called the Secretary for Relations with States, because we don't consider it necessarily foreign. In contrast to the Holy See, we've got the Vatican City State. Vatican just refers to it's an Etruscan term, 4 centuries BC, that goes to the geographical area around St. Peter's Basilica, west of the Tiber in Rome. Vatican City State was founded in 1929 with a concordat with Italy to give a geographical circumscription to preserve the sovereignty of the Holy See internationally. There had been this period from 1870 to 1928 when Italy was reunited, the Papal States were suppressed, and there was no area that corresponded to the Holy See. Much like between the Council of Vienna in 1815 and World War I in 1918, there was no Poland on the map, even though the Polish nation remained, because the Council of Vienna gave it part to Germany, Prussia, part to Russia, etc. So Vatican City State people want to refer to Holy See diplomacy as Vatican diplomacy. In the 1950s, there was always a fight at the United Nations because they always wanted to put Vatican rather than Holy See. But the way it works is the Vatican City State is the territory, the nation, you could say, would be the Holy See. And so all the diplomatic work is the Sancta Sedes. Over the course of time, the popes started to send out personal representatives. For us in the United States, for those who are Americans, those who come from democracy, we normally think of diplomats representing peoples. Throughout history, it was diplomats representing persons, namely monarchs. So they were a personal representative going forward, and that is maintained with the Holy See. He sends out personal representatives. In the early days, they were called apokrisarii. Apokrisarios is just a Greek word, he who responds, and responds for the Pope. Eventually, they were called legati or legates. Now they're called nuncii, or messengers of the Holy Father, but it's still the same function, personal representative somewhere else to some other head of state. They speak with plenipotentiary authority, not totipotentiary authority, but plenty, so almost everything. They can declare war. Ambassadors can declare war when they go over. It's quite powerful in representing countries. Let's move on. What are the goals? So just a little bit of a survey of the extent of how the church tries to be salt, light, and leaven. The Holy See has diplomatic relations with 183 different countries. There are 197 claimants to statehood in the world. So this is an incredible footprint. It's only the really huge countries like the United States that would have diplomatic relations with most. I was in Ireland. The Holy See is the dean of the diplomatic corps there, but there are only 54 countries in the whole world that have diplomatic relations with Ireland. The Holy See is 3.5 times more. I'm just showing you a few slides where you see the dates in which it was founded with the different countries. So you finish 183, and it's constantly growing. Who are the ones with whom we do not have diplomatic relations? We do not have diplomatic relations with a few Muslim states. We don't have diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. Don't have diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia, for example. Did you have a question? Quick question.
What does the star mean?
What does the
seraph?
I didn't see it.
Austria.
Yeah, there's just, it's a distinction in the dates when it was accepted by the Holy See and accepted by the Czech Republic. So the date would differ a little bit in terms of when it went into impact. Sorry about that. I was doing something fast. Holy See also has diplomatic relations with the EU, the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, special nature with the state of Palestine, which still hasn't been recognized as a state by the Security Council because the U.S. always vetoes anything that Israel asks the U.S. to veto. Participates in various intergovernmental organizations and bodies and international programs. You can see all of those there, many of which were observers, some of which were members, so I'll explain that in a second. And the Vatican City-State likewise belongs to certain things that are really tied on in to the functioning of city-state. So International Postal Union, no reason for that to be the Holy See, but that's inside baseball things. What are the goals of engagement for the Holy See? We're not concerned principally with what most states are, borders, economic benefits, military security, etc. This comes from Pope Paul VI. It's articulating the ethical principles that ought to underpin the social and political order on the basis of universally applicable principles that are as real as the physical elements of the natural environment. Nice way of saying the principles of the natural law. Holy See at the United Nations, when we went there, so basically when the United Nations was being formed in 1943, Pope Pius XII, who was a consummate diplomat and pope at the time, saw that there were two really big time problems with the UN. First was, how could you have an international organization purporting to promote equality of nations when five nations were patently unequal, what we call the P5 or the five permanent members of the Security Council who could veto anything at the Security Council. So the United States at the time, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, France, and China said it's going to be a problem. And it still is a problem 73 years later. Second problem that he saw is there's no enforcement mechanism for the resolutions of the General Assembly other than people's desire to keep their national honor in their word. And he said his fear was that the United Nations would just become the world's most prestigious debating society. And that remains a very actual concern because a lot of the things just are never implemented. But there was a certain harmony between the Catholic Church's social teaching and the UN. The UN has four pillars in its preamble. The first is to prevent the scourge of war. And the Church traditionally in Catholic social teaching has always sought to promote peace. Second pillar, human rights. The Church has always been a great defender of human rights and the human dignity from which it flows, because we're made in the image and likeness of God and called to communion with God. Third, development in general. And the Church has always tried to pull the poor out of poverty. Fourth, the UN fourth pillar is about observance of international laws, conventions, and treaties. And even back in the 5th century, the Church had the phrase pacta sunt servanda. Treaties, agreements need to be kept. They need to be guarded. So there was a great overlap between the bigger goals of the UN and Catholic social teaching. The Holy See maintained an observer status. At the beginning in the Charter of the United Nations, there was nothing like observers, but other international organizations had observer status. There were only 51 countries that originally joined the UN. No Axis nations could join, nobody who couldn't provide troops, nobody who couldn't provide adequate resources. So a lot of the nations extant at the time weren't able to join, but they wanted them, in a sense, to at least know what was going on and participate as they could. So they created this, I'm going to go about 5 minutes. They created this observer status. Over the course of time, there were as many as 18 countries that were observers at any one time. In 1964, the Holy See became an observer, but none of the rights and responsibilities were ever really defined. 2002, Switzerland was the penultimate observer state. They become a full member, and the UN came to the Holy See and said, "Do you also want to become a member?" John Paul II took 2 years to examine what he thought would be better. At the end of the 2 years, he decided we would retain observer status so that we could be neutral to many of the concerns, so that we could have a better prophetic role than constantly getting into the nitty-gritty of every vote. In 2012, Palestine became a second observer, but they don't have the same rights and responsibilities that the Holy See has. What an observer means is you can do everything every other member state except three things. You can't run for office, not that the Pope wants to be General Secretary of the United Nations. You can't initiate resolutions, but we can always get others to initiate it there. And you can't vote. So at the UN, most of what's done, there's a negotiation so that everybody's it's acceptable to everybody. Everybody loses a lot, most gain at least enough. And so 50 or 60 resolutions pass by acclamation immediately at the United Nations. So we don't lose all that much. We're able really to speak as much as we need to speak and to try to bring the light of social teaching to the debates facing the world community. When the popes have visited, as they have on five occasions, so Paul VI was the first in 1965, JP II came in 79 and 95, Pope Benedict in 2008, Pope Francis in 2015, an event that I helped organize. They've essentially said two things. First, the UN needs to exist. If the UN didn't exist, it would have to be created, because we have to have some body by which disputes could be settled without bilateral conflict. But at the same time, while there is a need for the UN to exist, the UN always is in need of reform. And it always points out the ways that the UN is clearly not living up to the hope that the peoples of the world give. Just like Ecclesia Semper Reformanda, that cry of the 1400s, that the church is in need of reform, we can say that the United Nations is Semper Reformanda, always in need of reform. Last point there is about the Catholicity of the United Nations. When Paul VI came in 1965, he said that at a temporal sphere, the United Nations purports to do what the Catholic Church seeks to do at a spiritual sphere. Serve all the people of the world. Bring something that's Catholic with a small C, universal, in terms of its outreach and solicitude. So he said there's a great possibility for interaction. The United Nations, sometimes people joke that after China and India, the Holy See is the third biggest state at the UN, because we represent 1.2 billion people. And we're actually with a global footprint. And that's one of the reasons why people listen more carefully to the UN, because we've got religious in particular and so many lay people on the ground all over the place doing a lot of the things that the UN says need to be done for peace in the world. What are the priorities of the Holy See? Just very quickly, first one's always peace, to try to prevent war. Peace requires so much of peace building: education, health, food, access to water and natural resources, all the rest of it. Without it, there can easily be war. Freedom, especially religious freedom, and freedom of conscience. At the universal level, still, there are great battles being fought here. This year, we're celebrating the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And there were a few nations that didn't sign up for that, mainly Muslim countries that don't want to see any conversion, right? So we've got that. And then on the other hand, you've got the aggressive secularists who are trying to suppress all freedom of conscience, because freedom of conscience implies that you've got a God that you're listening to. And they just don't want to give God any real prerogative, because it would prevent, in their own language, people from loving the ones they want. Right, loving the ones they choose. The collision between freedom of belief and the redefinition of marriage and the redefinition of gender, that's where there's a huge clash. The Holy See is fighting intrepidly at the UN about that. Fundamental human rights. So those were the ones more or less articulated in the UDHR, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There was a problem with UDHR. As part of the compromise, they didn't ground where those rights come from, right? Would have been better if they did, but they got most of these rights right as they listed them. And they formed a lot of these new constitutions as they went across the globe. And so it's a great document, but what's been happening is people have been using rights language to talk about what Pope Francis, in January this year, said the new rights of the 1960s. that are actually suppressing older rights, the rights that are in the UDHR. What are the rights in the 1960s? Right to kill babies in the womb. Right to kill old people. Right to have other people pay than you get free contraception. Right for preschoolers to be able to learn about homosexuality. Right of little kids not to have their parents tell them that they have any authority in their life. These types of things. Intercultural dialogue. Again, to prevent Sam Huntington's clash of civilization, we've got to bring people together, and the Holy See is always participating in that at a diplomatic level. Support for democratic institutions. This is most in consonance with the dignity of the human person made free. Development and seeking to lift the poor out of poverty. Boy, do we still have a lot of work to be done. There are still 1 billion people who live under $1.93 a day. And I hope that that should keep us up tossing and turning at night. Under $1.93 a day. And so the international community with these sustainable development goals, for good or ill, are really focused there. But there's a lot of work. Care for migrants and refugees, sorry for the typo. This is the big agenda item this year, Global Compact on Safe, Orderly, and Regular Migration, being negotiated in New York, and the Global Compact for Refugees being consulted on in Geneva, one of the other campuses of the United Nations. There's so much confusion in migration and refugee stuff today. I hope somebody might ask a question about it, but when we're saying regular, we mean legal. And the Holy See's interaction here never really gets out because people are agenderizing it in the reporting. The first thing the Holy See's always talking about is the right to remain. That people shouldn't have to feel that they need to flee their home country. What's going on in their home country? We've got to address those home countries. Talks about integration, that is a mutual process. That you can't come on in and not learn the local language and learn the local culture. It's talking about borders. That the borders aren't presumed to be open. And quotas. Pope Francis has said in 2 interviews that countries have limits with the amount of people that they're able to take in. But at the same time, he's constantly saying countries need to be as generous as they can because these people are fleeing terrible situations. But it's not this type of thing where just everybody welcome, put out this big, long, 1,933-mile welcome mat. It's not what he's talking about. There are limits, there are procedures, but when it's not regular, when it's not legal, that's where the traffickers come in, that's where so much injustice happens to those who are already suffering. And care for our common home, the environmental stuff. You know, when you start talking at the UN with the people who are suffering from some of the climactic change consequences, they're not making up that the seas are rising. They're losing shoreline all the time. And it's happening in our country too. Just go down to New Orleans. They're losing a football field a week in the marshes. Just think about that. Last slide. Pope Francis in Evangelii Gaudium, his pastoral plan on the joy of the gospel, said that the kerygma has a clear social content. The proclamation of the gospel has an immediate moral implication centered on charity. If we're not loving our neighbor, we're not getting the gospel. Our redemption has a social dimension because God in Christ redeems not only individuals, but also the social relations among them. He commented, reading the scriptures makes it clear that the gospel is not merely about our personal relationship with God, nor should our loving response to God be seen as an accumulation of small personal gestures to individuals in need, a kind of charity a la carte, or as what we would say, random acts of kindness. The gospel is about the kingdom of God. It's about loving God who reigns in our world. To the extent that he reigns within us, the life of society will be a setting for universal fraternity, justice, peace, and dignity. Both Christian preaching and life then are meant to have an impact on society. True Christian hope, which seeks the eschatological kingdom, always generates history. That we're in time. We're not of the world, but we're in the world. And so we change history, just like the Incarnation changed history. And those are the convictions that undergird the international diplomatic work of the Holy See. It's part of the Church's seeking to be salt of the earth, light of the world, and the leaven that raised the whole world up. I've seen some people taking some photos there. I've got good news for you. If you want this whole PowerPoint presentation, if it's helpful, just go to catholicpreaching.com, and in the right column, you'll see it. There'll be a PDF of this. There'll also be the PowerPoint, and later on this afternoon, I'll put up an audio. So thanks for your attention. Happy to take your questions. How much time do we have?
About
10 minutes for questions. Excellent. 1, 2, 3.
Can you tell me?